Hello and welcome to the Westport Book Festival podcast. On this podcast, we feature Stuart Kelly, the literary editor of the Scotland Sunday, and we invited him to read from his marvellous tome, The Book of Lost Books, which has just been re-released by Berlin in a second edition, a second expanded edition, which I highly recommend you going out to get. It's an amazingly erudite and fascinating event, and you're really in for a treat.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a delight to be here. I thought what I'd do is read a bit from the book, just to give you a sense of what it was I was investigating with it. And then open to questions. If you want to ask about the book, that's great. If you want to ask about being literary editor, that's fine as well. So I'll begin with the introduction and then do a few of the parts from the book. My mother claims it started with the Mr. Men. In a well-rehearsed pantomime of parental exasperation, she recounts how, after a family relative had given me a copy of one of Roger Hargreaves' stories, every holiday jaunt, weekend outing and Saturday shopping trip became a single-minded trawl of bookshops until I had every single one of the series. Mr. Bump needed Mr. Nosey. Mr. Tickle was lonely without Mr. Chatterbox. After I had finished this first collection, I swiftly became obsessed with the Doctor Who novelisations. This was followed by Fighting Fantasy, Dice and Decision books, and, as I approached my teens, Agatha Christie paperbacks. A pattern began to develop, a pattern that would turn obsessive. Having one or some of the titles within any given series was not sufficient. I seemed to be afflicted with a relentless monomania for all, a near compulsive necessity for closure and completeness. I even kept a book of lists to double-check that I really did know every episode of Doctor Who, with ticks against the ones I had bought and annotations about the ones that had never been novelised. When all of Agatha Christie's books were reissued with newly designed covers, the idea of having mismatched volumes struck me as unspeakably grotesque. I stalked the old stock, ferreted for the forgotten copies at the back of the shelves. It must have been with some trepidation on my 14th Christmas that my parents watched me unwrap a complete works of Shakespeare, Chancellor Press, 1982, printed in Czechoslovakia, and a selection of Wordsworth by W.E. Williams, introduction by Jenny Calder, Penguin Poetry Library, 1985. I presume that they were hoping that literature with a capital L was a large enough field in which my fixation might peter out. Instead, literature drove my zeal to new heights. The itch became a palpable rash when I started studying Greek, initially as a shameless ruse to avoid doing sports. Having saved up months of lunch money, I binged on Penguin classics of Hellenic drama. Two volumes of Aeschylus, two of Sophocles, three of Aristophanes, four of Euripides, and a solitary Menander. The first shock to my well-ordered system came as I peeled back the smart covers and began to browse through the introductions. I was under the impression I had just bought all of Greek drama, yet the prefaces and commentaries doomfully told otherwise. Aeschylus, whose seven plays I was holding, had actually written 80. There should have been 33 volumes of Sophocles, not a mere brace, and so on. The second, more grievous realisation came when reading Note 61 to Aristophanes' play The Thesmophoratzesi. Agathon, one of the most celebrated tragedians of his age, was 41 when this play was produced. None of his works have survived. None? Not a chorus, not a speech, not a hemistich? It seemed unthinkable. This, I decided at the age of 15, was a situation which I could rectify. I started compiling a list of lost books. It quickly superseded my book of lists with its everyone in Star Wars who wasn't made into an action figure, Doctor Who episodes lost by the BBC, and even a list of books that I should read. This new list would be of the impossible and the unknowable, of books that I would never be able to find, let alone read. It soon became clear that the subject was not limited to the Greeks, who, after all, had managed to keep on existing through Roman arrogance, Christian lack of interest, and a certain caliph's censorious view of libraries in general, and the Alexandrian Library specifically. From Shakespeare to Sylvia Plath, Homer to Hemingway, Dante to Ezra Pound, great writers had written works which I could not possess. The entire history of literature was also the history of the loss of literature. It is intrinsic to the nature of literature that it is written. Even work initially preserved in the oral tradition only truly becomes literature when written down. All literature thus exists in a medium, be it wax, stone, clay, papyrus, paper, or even, as in the case of the Peruvian knot language quipu, rope. Since it has a material dimension, literature itself partakes of the vulnerability of its substance. Every element conspires against it. Flame and flood, the desiccating air that corrupts, the loamy earth that decays. Paper is particularly defenceless. It can be shredded and ripped, stained and scrubbed away. Countless living things, from parasites and fungi to insects and rodents, can eat it. It even eats itself, burning in its own acids. The simplest form of loss is destruction. Though the Roman poet Horace proclaimed, "I have built a monument more durable than bronze," he expressed a hope about his work and not a certainty. The 19th century poet Gerald Manley Hopkins burned all of his early poetry as he dedicated his life to the beauty of God. James Joyce petulantly flung Stephen Hero, the first draft of A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, into the fire, but did not prevent his wife from saving what she could of it. Mikhail Bakhtin, this is actually my favourite bit in the whole book, exiled in Kazakhstan, used his work on Dostoevsky as cigarette papers after having smoked a copy of the Bible. Some writings are absent, presumed destroyed. Socrates, while in prison awaiting execution, wrote versifications of Aesop's fable. None of these have survived, and we rely on Plato's remembered and invented dialogues to catch even an echo of what Socrates himself might have written. Similarly, at some point, the only text of Aristotle's second book of Poetics was lost, and even the first book is made up from students' notes. A similar fate happened centuries later to Ferdinand de Saussure's course in general linguistics. When the publisher John Calder had to hastily relocate his offices in late 1962, many manuscripts, including The Sewing, the third part of Lars Lawrence's trilogy, and Angus Herriot's The Lives of the Librettists, were left behind in the old premises. The building, unpublished works and all, was demolished. If any undiscovered genius had sent their sole copy to Calder, undiscovered, they would remain. There are other works that are lost in the sense of being misplaced. A suitcase containing Malcolm Lowry's Ultramarine was stolen from his publisher's car, and the version we have had to be reconstructed from what was left in Lowry's bin. Allen Ginsberg recollected hearing fellow beat poet Gregory Corso reading in a lesbian bar in Greenwich Village, though you would search in vain through Corso's published oeuvre to find a poem with the line he remembers. "The stone world came to me and said flesh gives you an hour's life." How Ginsberg knew that the flesh was capitalised is a moot point. There are also those manuscripts that meet an untimely end, whose author's mortal existence is concluded before the work. The medieval Scottish poet William Dunbar wrote a haunting elegy for many of his dead fellow writers. Of the 22 poets he lists, there are 10 about whom we know nothing whatsoever. Virgil left instructions for the Aeneid to be torched, since he had not polished it to perfection. Sir Philip Sidney wrote his Arcadia once, but his own massive expansion of the work was abruptly terminated by a bullet on the battlefield at Zutphen. Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Dolliver Romance, Robert Louis Stevenson's Weir of Hermiston, and William Thackeray's Denis Duval are all partial classics. The SS put paid to the radical theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer's disquisition on ethics. Robert Musil and Marcel Proust never quite perfected their similarly voluminous masterpieces. And though we have enough extant to make them classics, a doubt scratches around these incomplete, unfinished, permanently paused novels. The last category of lost books is the eternally embryonic, works that the author planned and worked on, but never actually got round to the business of writing. Solon, the Athenian legislator, was too busy introducing income tax to turn the story of Atlantis into verse. The philosopher Boethius never managed to create his proof that Plato and Aristotle were in strict agreement. Sheridan told everyone that the sequel to The School for Scandal was going to be called Affectation, but did not bother writing it. Daudet's The Pentameron and Victor Hugo's Le Quinquegrone are both perpetually forthcoming. Lewis Grassic Gibbon was prevented from even beginning the novel he described in a letter as McLaurin and McDoon. And who knows whether or not Sir Arthur Conan Doyle might not have planned to reveal the true story behind the giant rat of Sumatra, which Watson once alluded to whilst Holmes was engaged with more immediate cases. Would Thomas Mann's Gaia have been the masterpiece while it was unwritten he believed it would be? Would Nabokov's never-written Speak America, the follow-up to his volume of memoirs, Speak Memory, have told us about the composition of Lolita or his triumphs in Lepidoptery? Often, these works are so ambitious, their completion is intrinsically impossible. Novalis's encyclopedia, covering all human knowledge, progressed little beyond his anxieties about whether the contents list would also serve as an index. Likewise, Leopardi's Encyclopedia of Useless Information is incomplete. One wonders what he would have made of the internet. One other category of lost books exists, but with an unreasonable optimism about the future, I have chosen not to discuss the illegible. Languages such as Linear A, Mayan, and the Easter Island script have not been deciphered, and might therefore be considered to contain whole lost literatures. However, after being thought incomprehensible for millennia, the decryption of the Rosetta Stone in the 19th century meant hieroglyphics could now tentatively be read. If this book is on the Quantinet in 5005, I would not wish my descendants to be troubled with having to make any deletions. Loss has symptoms and loss has predilections. Comedy displays many of the high-risk features, as do erotica and autobiography. The loss of Philip Larkin's diaries, combining, one presumes, all three, was almost inevitable. The censoring of the erotic also accounts for the loss of a book by the Abbasid court poet Ibn al-Shal al-Tahiri, whether panegyric, satire or handbook can never be known, entitled Masturbation. Over and above the content of the work, the multiplicity of theological and political regimes under which a piece of writing might find itself, its nurture rather than its nature, if you will, contribute towards extinction. From Savonarola to the Ayatollah Khomeini, religions have expressed themselves through book burning. Valentin Gentilis, who lived in Geneva, wrote a discursive piece on the idea that Calvin's Trinitarian doctrine inadvertently posited a fourth member of the Godhood. He was imprisoned for 8 years, recanted, and then was executed. His punishment, apart from the deprivation of his own life, was first to burn his own book in front of the judges. His sentence was considered light. The fact that Mandelstam's blisteringly satirical Stalin Ode survived at all is remarkable. Many others of his papers, drafts and scribbles were burned, flushed and otherwise discarded. His compatriot Isaac Babel was not so lucky. When he was arrested by Stalin's police on the 15th of May 1939, agents removed every single piece of paper from his flat. Certain authors, rather than certain works, become suspect. That there are not more entries on women writers, gay writers, and writers from out with Europe and the English language is partially my fault and partially the fault of those who systematically erased that work. Virginia Woolf famously tried to imagine Shakespeare's sister, but the inexorable and unchangeable nature of the past frustrates any attempt at giving a name to those who have been deprived of even a ghostly lost existence. Is becoming lost the worst that could happen to a book? A lost book is susceptible to a degree of wish fulfilment. The lost book, like the person you never dared ask to the dance, becomes infinitely more alluring simply because it can be perfect only in the imagination. We are nowadays almost incapable of believing in loss. As Project Gutenberg and databases like the Chadwick Healy continue to grow and offer the idea of a permafixed cyberspace culture, it is important and humbling to recognise that there is no automatic afterlife for literature. Prizes and plaudits are awarded on a daily basis, yet the ultimate fate of those lucky recipients is no more secure than that of the great prize winner Agathon. Even a repository like the British Library used to have old request slips with a box on the back, infrequently but occasionally ticked, stating volume lost. There is, equally, no guarantee that an intangible existence is also an unreachable state of being. drop a cup of coffee over your computer and you can see just how quickly text can disappear. If literature were a house, then the Book of Lost Books would be Rachel Whiteread's house, a poured into vacancy that is both the tomb and the trace. The Book of Lost Books is an alternative history of literature, an epitaph and a wake, a hypothetical library and an elegy to what might have been. Before I read the next section, I should say, when I finished the book, I typed up the final edits, I emailed it to the publishers, I phoned my wife and said, look, it's done, you know, finally away. And we bought a bottle of champagne and we drank it and we went to bed and I got up in the morning and somebody had stolen our computer and I hadn't saved it. And I'm almost angry that that Penguin did get that email. It would seem so perfect to write a book about lost books for 5 years and then lose it at the last instant. You know, there must be some Ned somewhere in Pilton that's got a computer that has the original first draft of Lost Books on it. I'm actually not too bothered about the fact it went out of print. For one thing, it meant that I sold a lot of copies. But also, the idea that it itself is slightly disappearing, that I can't actually find all the copies of it anymore, I find quite moving. I'm going to read a couple of bits of the later bit. Does anyone have any preferences? Do you want theology? Do you want classics?
Erotica.
We could do erotica. Let's have a look for some. There isn't that much mucky stuff in this. Okay, Sir Richard Burton. Witnessing cannibalism was one of the few ambitions Sir Richard Burton failed to satisfy. As an explorer, author, intelligence agent and diplomat, he had chalked up an astonishing number of firsts and an equally honourable number of bizarre near misses. He was the first European to perform the Hajj, the ritual pilgrimage from Medina to Mecca, disguised as a practising Muslim. He discovered the Great Lakes in the interior of Africa, though through illness did not succeed in locating the source of the Nile. He studied Mormons in Salt Lake City and met that religion's own St. Paul, Brigham Young. He toured the battlefields of Paraguay after the disastrous war waged by Francisco Lopez and his mistress Eliza Lynch. He was the first Christian to enter the Ethiopian Islamic stronghold of Harar, which was forbidden to outsiders, and with his redoubtable wife Isabel, he reached the city of Palmyra without the help of the Bedouins who controlled the trade routes. During an ambush in Somaliland, a spear was thrust through his cheeks. Burton's search for gold in the Midian failed, though he would have been a rich man if he'd been looking for oil. Similarly, during his consulship in West Africa, he failed to appreciate the pecuniary potential of an exceptionally sweet drink combining water and cola nuts, though he did patent a beverage called Captain Burton's Tonic Bitters. His peregrinations were distilled into a remarkable literary oeuvre comprising geography, ethnology, anthropology, poetry, swordsmanship, translation, satire, and a complete unexpurgated and annotated edition of the Arabian Nights in 16 volumes. He mastered over 20 languages, as well as countless local dialects, wrote definitively on the Portuguese poet Camões, and published 47 works in his lifetime, followed by several posthumous volumes. Physically courageous and intellectually daunting, he should have been a boy's own hero, but a sticky film of innuendo and rumour clung to his reputation, and not without cause. Burton never suffered fools gladly, and his indiscreet criticisms of imperial policy in the Indian subcontinent and Africa earned him the disapprobation of his superiors. He was arrogant, ambitious, and fond of bitingly sarcastic reproaches. Perhaps most damagingly for his hopes of advancement, his insatiable curiosity extended into the realms of the erotic. As a young soldier in Karachi, with a proven flair for languages and an unparalleled ability to pass himself off as a native, he was asked by Sir Charles Napier to prepare a confidential report on alleged homosexual brothels. The resulting document was authoritative to a shocking degree, sparing the reader no detail about the relative practices of eunuchs, pederasts and catamites. Although the report was supposed to be destroyed, it was skimmed by the eyes of Napier's successor as governor of Sindh, the civilian R.K. Pringle, who was so shocked he forwarded the document to the authorities, recommending that Burton be immediately dismissed. The actual report has never resurfaced in the annals of bureaucracy, but the beginnings of Burton's notoriety as a Byronic libertine were established. Furthermore, his successful impersonation of a Muslim pilgrim led to persistent rumours that he had actually converted, and that he harboured a deep animosity not only to missionaries, but to the Christian religion in general. Burton, half-jokingly, later claimed he had broken every one of the Ten Commandments. That any respectable Victorian woman would marry the infamous Burton was unlikely. That an ardent Roman Catholic girl from an aristocratic family would elope to do so is even more surprising. Isabel Arundel had been in love with Burton since she met him at the age of 19, and bolstered by a gypsy prophecy that she would marry a Burton, she turned down countless suitors, flew in the face of her mother's protestations, and ran off with him. Isabel, in many ways, was the ideal companion. She combined self-will and submissiveness to an extraordinary degree. Having single-mindedly won her man, she then advised future brides to tolerate everything. In a phrase rich with metaphorical possibilities, she counselled them to let your husband smoke at home, since they would assuredly find someplace else to should it be frowned upon. She shocked guests by wearing trousers and accompanied him on some of his most dangerous escapades. Unstintingly loyal, she acted as his literary agent and harangued lukewarm reviewers. That still happens, by the way. It was only after his death that erstwhile long-life friends launched a cacophony of animosity against her. After her own death, numerous biographers colluded in depicting her as an unfit, inferior partner. Richard Burton made Isabel his literary executor in the year of his death. He had already published his translation of the Kama Sutra and the explicit commentary on sexual behaviour that accompanied his Tales of 1001 Nights. Both of them were aware of the levels of censorious prudery in late Victorian society. The Edinburgh Review, in its notice of Burton's 1001 Nights, compared rivalled translations and declared, "Galland is for the nursery, Lane for the study, and Burton for the sewer." Burton's attitude was one of frustrated defiance. If he were prosecuted for obscenity, he intended to arrive at court with the Bible, Shakespeare and Rabelais, and ask how much of those works was to be suppressed too. A vein of utter devilry runs through some of his correspondence. When working on a study of the geographical limits in which sodomy was permissible, he hoped that Mrs. Grundy, the personification of 19th century Puritanism, would howl on her big bum to her heart's content. Isabel had always been more cautious. She had prepared a Bowdlerised version of the 1001 Nights dedicated to the women of England, and her frequent defences of Burton's views became the targets for gleefully malicious reviewers. Nonetheless, before he died, Burton trusted her with his extant manuscripts and prepared an inventory of what was to be burned. In later years, the myth of Lady Burton's embittered and ignorant act of arson would be elevated to the status of fact. The poet Swinburne, who had admired Isabel as a wife, would refer to her as a harpy once she was a widow, his vitriol exacerbated by the fact she had organised for her unconscious, agnostic husband to be given extreme unction. Isabel Burton did burn some papers, most notably the entire 12,000 pages of his translation of the Arabic erotic classic, The Scented Garden. Burton had previously written a version based on French translations entitled The Perfumed Garden, and had been engaged in an edition from the original at the time of his death. Isabel did, however, prepare various posthumous works for publication. When news of the destruction of the Scented Garden broke, rumours started that Isabel had actually secreted the manuscript in her husband's crypt. Unscrupulous publishers kept hinting they had access to another copy, which would shortly appear alongside other works by Burton. In light of the difficulties managing the estate and fending off unauthorised or counterfeit editions, her own will stipulated that everything should be burned. Her papers, her manuscripts, his unpublished works, his remnants. It was not wholly successful. A work which Burton had wanted destroyed, an essay on the mysterious Arabian sect of Jews who supposedly performed human sacrifices, appeared after Isabel's death. It was following Isabel's, not Richard's, death that the real literary cremation took place. Burton's journals from 1872 to 1890, alongside her own teenage diaries, their letters, his unfinished manuscripts on the lowlands of Brazil, North, Central and South America, Syrian proverbs, notes on the eunuch trade, translations of Ovid, Ausonius and Ariosto, studies of polygamy, all were erased. Isabel had already destroyed her own book on the Sixth Sense, but it was not out of spite, but out of love, that she had ever burned anything at all. Had their correspondence alone been spared, the speculation about the relationship between these two remarkable and devoted people would have been instantly stilled. But her detractors had done their job well, and Isabel would be blamed for the pyre in subsequent biographies. Few would mention that Burton had already lost a lot of unpublished material during a warehouse fire in 1860. Amongst those papers was one study which might have proved more interesting than yet more erotological investigations. As a soldier in Karachi, Burton had kept 40 monkeys in a house and was attempting to use his formidable literary abilities to understand their language. The results of this experiment, a vocabulary of 60 words, were lost 36 years before the more conspicuous conflagration. I'm sorry that wasn't about erotica, but actually, monkey language book kind of trumps that one. I'll maybe just read one more. I'll do a classical one. In fact, I'll do Agathon, the person who started the whole thing off. At the close of the 5th century BC, King Archelaus of Macedonia was gradually realising his ambitions to transform the northern Greek kingdom into something more substantial than a semi-barbarous satellite state. He wished to form a nation that did not have to second-guess the strengths of Athens and Sparta and side with whichever seemed to be in the ascendant. Admittedly, he had had to murder his half-brother to gain the throne. Nonetheless, since the last decade of the century, an influx of exiles from Athens had greatly contributed to his ongoing programme of civilisation. His palace was decorated by the painter Zeuxis, whose trompe-l'oeil were so convincing that birds reputedly attempted to snatch grapes that were no more than pigment on plaster. He listened to the intricate instrumental music of Timotheus, who had increased the number of strings on the cithara in order to turn his mental compositions into actual sounds. As Athens became ever more militaristic, its much-vaunted intellectual freedoms became curtailed. Around 404 BC, both Euripides and his friend and colleague in the theatre, Agathon, decided that not only their finances, but their lives were imperiled by Athens' drift into doctrinaire repression. They were right. In 399 BC, the philosopher Socrates, with whom they had both been close, was sentenced to death for corrupting the young. The court of King Archelaus must surely have appeared a relatively enlightened place to retire. Agathon had suffered carping and derision from the Athenians. Even the comic playwright Aristophanes, whose wit notoriously spared neither friend nor foe, had lampooned his method of composition in a play called The Thesmophoratzai. Agathon had been presented, dressed as a woman, justifying his odd vestments by saying that to write a female role, one had to think as a woman, and some moderate transvestitism helped that process no end. Sly digs at his preference for homosexual to heterosexual relationships were accompanied by pastiches of his precious, ornate style. Agathon's over-refined and rhetorically embellished poetry had been criticised often enough, and his retort to the critic who suggested excising those purpler passages had erred on the side of self-absolved arrogance. "Would you purge Agathon of Agathon?" he said. Other innovations introduced by him had been equally sceptically received. Aristotle, years later, would remember that even Agathon had been censured for trying to incorporate too much of an epic sweep into a single play. He had even severed the link between the chorus and the action of the play, reducing their role to mere interludes. Most contentiously, he had introduced an element into tragedy that had broken with every tradition: originality. His play Antheus, or The Flowers, had been based on a plot of his own devising. It is hard to fully imagine the shock to the audience. Instead of an Oedipus whose incest and blinding would be fully expected, or a wounded Philoctetes, or a passion-struck Phaedra, there were characters whom nobody recognised. Nobody knew what was going to happen next, let alone at the end. The Lost Antheus is the only original tragic plot we know of. Later Greek authors returned to the well-worn myths. All that said, Agathon had been successful. He had won the first prize in 416 BC, and the celebration afterwards would later be the setting for Plato's Symposium. Even in that imaginative reconstruction, lineaments of Agathon's character emerge. His lover, Pausanias, is present and gives a defence of homosexuality. Agathon's speech attests to his power of invention and slightly florid tone. Although Phaedrus begins the debate by citing Hesiod and the lost author Akuseleus, who both maintain that love is the oldest of the gods. Agathon begins by declaring, conversely, that love is the youngest of gods. He quotes the lost Sthenobia of Euripides, saying that love can turn men into poets, and argues with sophistication that since love is the strongest of passions, all other passions must be subordinate to it. Socrates gently unpicks the muddle of ingenuity. As Agathon and Euripides, having finally decided to skip to Macedonia, headed towards the northern fastness of King Archelaus, they may have discussed how best to write works that would flatter and challenge their new ruler. They may have compared notes on the veteran tragedian Sophocles and his recent remarkable Oedipus at Colonus. What opportunities and advancements lay ahead? After all, they had done enough to guarantee their immortality. Put Agathon into any internet search engine. Read out the copious commentaries on Plato's Symposium. You will find a lot of information about precision tool manufacturing, with a special emphasis on ball sleeves, tool guiding and plastic moulding. There is a kennel club, a web hosting service, and an academic publisher specialising in German political science. There are details about a North European rock band, Agathon's favourite, who played in Liverpool once, and synopses of the 1975 movie Assault on Agathon, directed by Laszlo Benedek, about a Greek Second War veteran thought dead who returns to fight again. In January of that same year, Marvel Comics' Haunt of Horror 5 features Agathon the Tempter, a servant of Kudros, also known as Satan, who was impaled on a spiked sculpture by Satan's daughter, who has the imaginative name Satana. Jonathan Edwards played Agathon in season 3 of Xena Warrior Princess, where he is now a warlord with magic armour from Hephaestus, the god of metalworking. The Wreckage of Agathon, Harper and Row 1970, by John Gardner, is a philosophical satire and was compared by one Amazon reviewer to Borges. There are no extant plays by Agathon. Two fragments of Agathon's work were used by Aristotle to emphasise and illustrate his arguments. These are the only quotes we have from him. "Art loves chance, and chance loves art," reads one, "and chance has snatched any art Agathon was once thought to have had. Not even the gods can change the past," reads the other, a fitting epitaph, perhaps, for all the lost books. Thank you. Well, as I say, any questions? And I might end with just another reading right at the end.
Have you included libraries as well as individual books?
I've included quite a lot about the Alexandrian Library.
Is it a big chapter in that one?
Because Callimachus, who was the librarian there, we have lost most of his works. But it was kind of disastrous that it's often erroneously said that that Islam is to blame for that. In fact, Julius Caesar destroyed far more of the Alexandrian Library than the Caliph did when they attacked there. But yeah, you know, the whole loss of libraries is a kind of undercurrent to the whole book. That, you know, we have, well, even when the year I published the book was 2005, and in that year the central library in Baghdad was hit by an American bomb. Now, who knows what was destroyed there? Certainly the Americans never exactly said, you know, these are the things that we've lost there.
So do you have any a list of any Japanese books or any Chinese books, of course?
I did, Confucius. We have lost one of the six books of the six classics, his Book of Music. For Japan, I did Eharu Saikaku, the famous haiku writer. He was called the 10,000 verse poet because he once sat down and composed a haiku every 3 seconds for 2 days, and nobody bothered writing them down. They just kind of marvelled at the fact that he was churning these out. I'd have liked to have done more. I mean, there's much. Obviously, the big loss was when the first emperor, Shi Huang Ti, became emperor. There was a thing called the burning of the books that he decided that every book would be burnt in the empire. So they would start with sort of year one and none of this old fusty stuff behind. He did keep one copy of every book for his personal library. You know, that was a famous disaster for Chinese, and that's when we lost Confucius's Book of Music. That later, the second emperor, when the Han Dynasty takes over, the emperor demands that they carve an edition of Confucius in stone so it can never be lost again. But they'd already lost one by then.
Since you've written your book, have any of the more modern losses actually reappeared in any way?
There has been some Sappho rediscovered. Sappho, you know, the famous Greek female poet, there was 8 lines were discovered in the Codex. The thing I'll read at the end, in part, is about the fact that we are discovering lost works now, particularly with the Library at Herculaneum, that it's being gradually deciphered what is there. So we'll get quite a lot of classical stuff. I don't know if we'll ever get the more modern things. The one that is always at the back of my brain is Shakespeare. We know there are 3 plays by Shakespeare which we don't have any copies of. A proper copy of Pericles, Love's Labour's One, and Cardenio. Now, it was 1915 was when they found the last quarto we didn't know about. That isn't all that long ago. And there is a possibility that an edition of Cardenio or of Love's Labour's One could turn up. When I wrote about Menander, I mean, one of the other things about lost books which always entertained me was actually when the books come back, it's really disastrous. You know, Menander was praised by everyone, and they finally managed to reconstruct a whole play from the Oxyrhynchus papyrus. And it was rubbish. It was really, really awful. And, you know, this was a man whom everybody had said was the great comic dramatist, and when he actually got the plays, it was slightly worse than a 1970s British sitcom. You know, there's, you know, the first bit they actually translated began with a man coming on stage and saying to his friend, "Oh, you know, it's terrible. I got so drunk last night, I raped somebody." And then the girl comes on and says, "Oh, it's terrible. I've been raped." And of course, her boyfriend raped her, so that's all okay. And you think, you know, this is just ghastly, ghastly stuff. G.S. Kirk, the Regius Professor of Greek, said, "Can anyone explain to me why Menander is anything other than a cold fish?" And, you know, wouldn't it be awful if we had a Shakespeare play and it was just a bit rubbish?
I've got a question that kind of builds on from that, because obviously you're very well read, and there must be, you must have a very good knowledge of classic literature. Is there a book that you would happily have us lose?
Oh yes, plenty. In my other sort of life as literary editor, there's very many. J.K. Rowling. Irvin Welsh. Is there anyone that? Well, I suppose if we're being serious, there are certain books which really are incredibly offensive. I wouldn't shed a tear if all of Desaad's work disappeared. People make claims for Desaad and how great he is as a writer. It's not, basically. I suppose the real question is, what would I lose if I could get something back in return? I'd swap J.K. Rowling for Agathon, I think. Plus, it means that graduate students get so much more fun to do. I mean, the way in which classics is kind of shrinking just because there isn't much left to really research. You know, people having to do doctorates on Silius Italicus just because he's left behind. In terms of who would I absolutely get rid of? D.H. Lawrence, probably. You know, kind of fascist, not very good, not even very sexy. You know, having to, I remember that was a point when I was a student reading Lawrence and just thinking, there must be something wrong with my head. I just don't get why this is supposedly good.
Are you aware of any examples of people alleging that they've lost things in order to generate interest? I mean, you know, for instance, the fact that you've got an unfinished symphony, Schubert's got an unfinished symphony, somehow there's a glamour to that.
I think it's something that happens more in music and visual arts than in writing. Mayakovsky said the great work of art is only abandoned, never finished. And certainly, when you think about Mahler and his... Well, Mahler and Bruckner both were obsessed with the idea that you could only do 9 symphonies. So they would go to endless levels to try and convince you that the symphony wasn't a symphony, so Das Lied von der Erde, or having Symphony Zero, just to try and get round it. Some authors have lost books recently. Louis de Bernier lost the whole book. He writes in a shed at the bottom of his garden and somebody broke in and nicked the computer. But, you know, given his critical estimation after Captain Corelli, I don't think anybody's really all that sorry that we've lost it. But there is this idea that somehow maybe that was a really good one and we just had the ones he had to knock out to solve it. Poems, I think, disappear more than prose. I mean, if you're going to write a novel, you're going to pretty much try and make sure it gets published in some form. Whereas poems, people throw off and you don't hear again. You don't hear for a long time.
Isn't it a rather nice idea that poems that do survive will have echoes about them that we won't be able to pin down of works that the poets read that we now can't?
Yeah, absolutely.
Contemporaries, poetry that didn't survive.
Absolutely. I mean, the big one like that is Gallus, the love poet in Rome, that, you know, every one of the other love poets, you've got an event about Catullus on later here tonight, and I'd really recommend you go to it. But, you know, lots of love poets all said Gallus was the guy who really knew how to do this. And I think the only line we have of him is Amor vincit omnia. You know, if you're going to have one line, that's a pretty good one to get. But the idea that somehow they are threaded through the extant work. I come back to Shakespeare on that, because in terms of the publication of Shakespeare's works, you get them kind of during his lifetime, individual plays are published. So that's kind of like the single release. And then you get the album release, which is the folio with all the plays in it. And when they reprinted that for the fourth time, they included huge numbers of plays that we now think aren't by Shakespeare. I'll just for a quick flick and find what they are. Locrine, a tragedy. Edward III, the Yorkshire tragedy. Sir John Oldcastle, the Merry Devil of Edmonton. The London Prodigal, The Birth of Merlin, The Puritan, Arden of Faversham. Now, maybe they weren't all by Shakespeare, but I think there's a very good chance that he'd put something into those plays. You know, if he just knocked off a speech that would fit in. I mean, he was a man of the theatre. He worked to commission. And the idea that we have all these plays that might have just glimmers of Shakespeare through it, if only we could sort of tune our ear properly to it.
I'd be interested to hear what you think maybe modern threats are to books, and also your ideas on what the internet might or might not do to the survival of more text or text from a greater and more diverse range of writers.
It's a really interesting question, that. There's a big problem about to happen in terms of literary biography. Now, I've reviewed the new biography of William Golding. Now, William Golding, we've got letters that he sent to his publisher, that all the rest of it. If you're going to do a biography of Martin Amis, you wouldn't be able to get his emails. Mm-hmm. The literary biography depends upon correspondence, mm-hmm. and correspondence is now done, you know, through texts, through emails, through that kind of thing. So in terms of what we know about authors, that's a big problem. In terms of the internet as a way of preserving text, well, it works up to a point. The Chadwick Healy database that Oxford put together didn't have any Walter Scott because they didn't know he was a poet. Texts do get corrupted. I've got a good friend who works at the British Library who is working the whole time on how on earth do you retain online magazines. Because even if you can actually save the page or print off all the pages, the links will break. Mm. So the way in which it is an integrated part of something always slips away. The real question for the internet, and this is something which I'm thinking about the whole time now, is why isn't there yet a work of art that can only exist on the internet? every other technological advancement, whether it was radio, film, television, automatically had a kind of its own aesthetic was created. But, you know, what can I see on the internet that is a work of art that is only on the internet, that isn't just the internet as a platform for other media? I think that's the $1,000 question. If somebody can actually turn the internet into a proper artistic medium in its own right. But that touched on some of the things that I'll read in this last little bit, just the end of the book. It's just kind of depressing, but I quite like it. What better symbol for the facile optimism of the 1980s than the spinning mirror of the compact disc? The CD seemed like a heaven-sent solution to the problem of preserving recorded sound. Magnetic tape was prone to snarling, vinyl deteriorated from the very first minute it was played, and the stylus roughly ground down the very fabric of what it was supposed to be playing. They were no less frail than the earliest wax cylinders. The CD was different, a futuristically gleaming circle, digitally encoded, replayed by the softest caress of a laser. Adverts showed them being smeared with jam and dunked in dishwater, and yet the information burned on them did not suffer in the slightest. Of course, there were caveats about dust, magnets and scratches, but with moderate care and attention, the CD fulfilled a millennia-old human dream, perfect imperishability. Or so we were led to believe. In the early years of the 21st century, CD users started to complain that the discs were becoming erratic. Moreover, they were subtly changing colour from silver to gold, a phenomenon known as bronzing, or more prosaically, CD rot. At first, the industry retorted by saying that all the stunts and pranks featured in adverts were not to be taken seriously, and that clear guidelines about damp, heat, electrical fields and not touching the surface of the disc made it obvious that a CD required a little special handling. When, however, CDs that had been kept in their packaging since purchase also showed signs of deterioration, another explanation had to be found. A protective lacquer was dropped on the disc to seal it, and, it was suggested, in some cases a centrifugal force had insufficiently coated the CD. This allowed air, specifically oxygen, to penetrate to the aluminium layer containing the data. The aluminium was oxidising, just as copper turns to verdigris. In short, the CD was very, very slowly charring. Permanence eludes us once again. At the same time as the CD was being busily marketed, a remarkable discovery was made at Herculaneum, the town buried in 79 AD when Vesuvius erupted. During the excavations of a building later known as the Villa de Papyri, or the House of the Papyrus, archaeologists realised that the burned bundles, previously thought to be grain bags, were actually ancient manuscripts. The force of the pyroclastic explosion had carbonised them in their entirety and instantaneously. Normally, the organic elements of papyrus means that they gradually corrode. The intense heat of the Vesuvius eruption had eradicated these compounds. The blackened scrolls were, in effect, disinfected. The very same catastrophe that had destroyed the town had preserved the manuscripts. Reading them, however, was a painstaking process. The heat had rendered them friable, only just holding out against their own disintegration into ash. Slowly, in preservative solutions, they were unwrapped. X-ray and digital photography gradually revealed the difference between the black of ink and the black of burnt papyrus. Actually, it was the same technology as is used on the Hubble Space Telescope, I later discovered, they used to read it. Computer enhancement clarified the image, and a text thought lost forever was read once again. To date, the library at Herculaneum has not offered us a copy of the Margites, or a play by Agathon, or a collection of poetry by Gallus. Many of the texts were already known. The idea that a library would lack an Aeneid or an Iliad would have created more mysteries than it solved. Many Epicurean tractates, hitherto unknown, have been clawed back from the edge, and many more scrolls remain to be deciphered. Similarly, at Vindolanda on Hadrian's Wall in Northumberland, a refuse pit, which previous generations of archaeologists dug through enthusiastically in search of combs or brooches or statuettes, has been revealed to contain wooden writing tablets preserved in the peaty soil. They had been indistinguishable from the dirt. Letters, requisitions, and yet more copies of Virgil have been identified, but as yet, no great new ancient work. The papyrus and the CD, the codex and the web page. Human ingenuity strives not only to find a permanent medium for its culture, but to reclaim that which was fixed on a more fragile form. It is a struggle we cannot win. The second law of thermodynamics, the law of entropy, proves that there is no perfect way to change energy from one form into another. In any transformation, a dissipation occurs. Two billiard balls click, and the momentum transfers from one to the other with a slither lost in the click and the heat or the momentary abrasion between the balls. If we look beyond our own tiny section of this universe's history, the picture appears bleak. The coronosphere of our sun will eventually edge forward, engulfing Mercury, frazzling Venus. In thousands and thousands of years, Earth will scorch like an insignificant piece of paper. As the Bible says, the skies will roll up like parchment. Perhaps by then, like a long-lost science fiction story, future humanity will have fled to a safer, moister, rocky planet with a Noah's Ark of knowledge. This only defers the inevitable. All matter will eventually be spread as fine interstellar dust or concentrated in a black hole's gorged interior. Loss is not an anomaly or a deviation or an exception. It is the norm. It is the rule. It is inescapable. Why then do we strive? In trying to preserve what makes us human, we prove our own humanity. A German proverb says, "Einmal ist keinmal, once is never." This is not true. Something does not lose its meaning or its significance just because it ceases to be. Just as any human life reverberates, causes change and affects our thinking and feeling even after the death of the individual person, so does our culture, that accumulation of countless lost lives. We struggle unsuccessfully against oblivion, and that struggling itself is our only success. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Stuart. I really hope you enjoyed that event. It was fantastic to be at, and Stuart is always an erudite companion. You can hear Stuart Kelly this year on the 25th of June at 5 p.m. discussing his new book, Scotland, as well as his musings on collective nouns. So be sure not to miss that. More details on westportbookfestival.org. And the second expanded edition of the Book of Lost Books is now available from Berlin.